This is WKMS, Murray State's NPR station. We're online at WKMS.org. Good morning and welcome to a Sounds Good news forum on gun control. I'm Chad Lampe. In this hour, we're going to discuss current laws, current gun laws, and proposed federal and state gun laws. We'll also take your questions via Facebook on the WKMS page. You can send us a message through Twitter at WKMS. You can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. And you can also call in your question now at 800-599-4737, and we will take that question for you and send it into the studio. Again, that number is 800-599-4737. I'm joined this morning by a panel of guests, including Murray Police Department's Crime Prevention Sergeant Dave Howe, a licensed clinical social worker and Murray State faculty member Elena Chavis, and federally licensed firearms dealer and co-owner of First Choice Firearms in Murray, Tracy McKinney. I should also note that we've invited eight members of Kentucky's House of Representatives that have sponsored House Bill 265 relating to gun control in Kentucky, which we'll discuss a bit about that bill a little bit later in the program. But lead sponsor Mary Lou Marzian had initially committed to join us today, but had a late scheduling conflict. So we do apologize for not having an expert of this bill represented today on this panel. And we will keep our conversation directed toward our individual areas of expertise for our panel this morning. And we will also take your questions and answer them to the best of our ability. And we'd like to first, again, I'd like to welcome all of you, Tracy, Dave, and Elena. Thank you very much for taking time to meet with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's first just kind of set the stage here for our listeners to let them know what exactly are the current gun laws that we must abide by in the state of Kentucky. And Dave, I think this kind of directly speaks to you and your experience in law enforcement. And specifically, what type of guns currently are illegal in the Commonwealth?
Chad, currently the Commonwealth of Kentucky doesn't have any prescriptions other than what federal law already keeps people from having. And those are things like fully automatic weapons. A lot of times people would call that a machine gun. And also silencers and suppressors and what's called a destructive device, which is explosives. Those things, some of those you can have if you go through the proper federal procedures. You have to apply for basically a tax stamp, go through a little more of a background investigation. But as far as regular firearms, pistols, rifles, shotguns, things that had been included under the assault weapons ban, those are all legal to possess in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. We don't do anything more restrictive than federal law.
Explain to me what are the current guns that are legal. What is a semi-automatic weapon? Explain how a semi-automatic weapon works.
A semi-automatic weapon is a weapon that every time you pull the trigger, it fires. You don't have to do a separate action to make the gun fire the next round. For example, the difference between a manually operated shotgun and a semi-automatic shotgun, for example. With a manually operated shotgun, you have to rack the slide to put the next round in the chamber. But with a semi-automatic shotgun, you just have to keep pulling the trigger, and every time you pull the trigger, it will fire one round.
So a burst of shots, if you were to pull the trigger one time and more than one bullet came out like in succession, would that be considered a fully automatic weapon?
That's correct, Chad. That's a fully automatic firearm. And like I said, that's something that you have to go through several extra steps to be able to own. And Tracy could probably speak more to this, but no fully automatic weapons that were manufactured after a certain date, I believe it's 1982, are allowed to be possessed. No new ones are allowed to come into the market, and a lot of restrictions like that. But those are all federal restrictions.
Explain to me any bans on bullets or magazines. Are there any?
Not in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Once again, over and above federal law. There are certain kinds you're not allowed to possess. Something called a frangible round, which comes apart in a much more it comes apart a lot more than a normal bullet would. But as far as other ammunition restrictions or magazine restrictions, there are no restrictions other than the federal.
So no, I'm not completely up to date on all federal guidelines, but are armor-piercing rounds considered legal or illegal?
Currently, that you are allowed to possess them.
Okay. So there are no limits on a magazine. You could have a magazine with 50 rounds in it if you wanted.
Could have one with over 100 rounds.
Let's talk about how you enforce the current laws. I know that we'll talk about gun background checks in a moment for people to acquire a licensed firearm, but what about how you would approach someone, or how do you determine whether or not someone in possession of a firearm is possessing it legally in your position?
Well, that's actually pretty easy for us to do. Currently, the restriction is that anyone who has been convicted of a felony is not permitted to have a firearm. And that's pretty easy for us to check on. If we encounter someone who has a firearm and we have reason to believe, we just simply call dispatch and have them run a criminal history through the computer system, and that'll come back showing that they do have a felony record, and then they can be charged with being a felon in possession of a handgun.
Are there any processes that you do to I mean, I guess your first question, if you maybe pull someone over at a traffic stop, is to ask if they have any firearms in the vehicle?
Well, that's not a question that we ask right away, unless we have some reason to believe, probable cause to believe that they have a firearm. And even if we do have cause to believe, unless we have a reason to believe that they are illegally possessing a firearm, it's not really something that's going to come up. Now, I will tell you that when we make a traffic stop, we can run the license plate, and the registered owner's license will come up. And if they do have a concealed carry permit, that information will come up as well.
Tracy, let's talk about the background checks that you institute whenever you sell a firearm at your store.
Sure.
Tell us, just explain the current background check system, if you could. Give us an overview. There may be a fair amount of people in the audience that have never purchased a gun.
Absolutely, and that's fair. The first thing they're going to complete is what we call Form 4473, and that's an ATF form, and everyone that purchases a firearm has to complete that application. There are different questions on there that will qualify them or disqualify that person from purchasing that firearm that day. We check a photo ID, and it has to be a government-issued ID with the photo on there. We complete that information, and then we go. Our computers are tied into the FBI computers, if you will, under the NICS check. And so we will key all the information that's been input on this application into the system. Then we send that to the FBI, and then they give us a response as to whether the person can actually proceed, which means actually transact the deal that day, or the person could be denied, and we would not know why they're denied. It's just a denial, or they could be delayed. And on the delay would be a three-day delay, and it's three full days. So if one came in today, which and applied, their first day wouldn't start until Monday. So it'd go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and so then Thursday they could actually pick the firearm up if they got a proceed within that period of time. Sometimes they may need FBI may need a little extra time to do an additional background check or check some other things out. Similar names can cause them to dig in a little bit deeper.
And so you said there would be three reasons when they notify you whether or not they've been allowed to have a gun. One of them, you said there might be a reason you don't know about. They could just outright flatly deny someone.
Yeah, they'll just say deny, and due to all the privacy acts and everything, the FBI will not disclose that information to me. However, if that was the case, then we'll give the client a denial card or delay card. It's a form that's multi-purpose. If they're denied, it gives that person instructions on what they need to do if they feel that they've been wrongly denied, and that does happen sometimes. They will contact the FBI directly. They'll give them what's called the NICS transaction number, and then they'll explain the appeals process that they'll go through.
Kentucky, in research, we found that Kentucky has the highest rate, you call it NICS or NICS, has the highest number of background checks performed annually, at least in 2012, with 1.2 million checks. That's more than any other state in the country, and twice as much as Texas, which it seems really interesting to me that Kentucky's numbers are so high. Do you have any indication as to why these numbers are so high?
Just part of our heritage. That's all I can come up with.
Would you assume that there are just that many more people applying for guns in the Commonwealth? And because that's so, if you were purchasing multiple guns, say you went and you bought a handgun on Monday and you decided on Friday you wanted to buy a rifle, do you have to perform the same check?
Yes, sir. Each time a firearm is purchased, The 4473 has to be completed and the background check has to be completed. Now, one thing, and you gave an example of a handgun and a long gun, okay? Let's take an example if it was two handguns and they purchased a handgun on Monday and then they came back to purchase one on Friday. Then I'm required by under my license to complete another form, and that form is faxed to, and it's called the multiple handgun report. It's faxed to both the FBI and to the local sheriff's department. So the agencies are aware that people, you know, would be purchasing two handguns within a five-day period.
Does that go to the city police as well, Dave, or does that simply go to the sheriff's department?
No, the city police doesn't get a copy.
No, it goes to, under the ATF rules, they consider our sheriff's department as our chief law enforcement for us to contact under the definitions there. We wouldn't have a problem sharing that with the Murray Police Department by any means.
And I imagine the press relating to the discussion of whether or not there will be an assault weapons ban or whether or not there will be a high-capacity magazine ban has really, no doubt, probably helped your business at First Choice Firearms in Murray.
Well, unfortunately, the things that have triggered our politicians to jump on the bandwagon, so to speak, it's an unfortunate situation. But our politicians surely have become good sellers, our best salespeople, if you will, for the firearms. People have gone, I call it the Chicken Little syndrome, that the sky's falling on ammo. Ammo's hard to get. Firearms are hard for us to obtain right now to sell. We've got a good supply at the store, but each and every day we see that dwindle down a little bit more as well.
And could you give me a ballpark on the percentage of the amount of weapons that you are selling or magazines that you are selling that would be included in a potential ban? Are you selling a fair amount of assault-style weapons? Are you selling a lot of high-capacity magazines?
Well, with all due respect, we like to refer to them as sporting rifles.
Sporting rifles.
And it depends on which definition that you use. An assault is something that I feel that you would actually do to someone else, cause them harm.
That does make it a bit hard to argue for, doesn't it?
with all due respect. But on the sporting rifles, that's probably about 25% of our sales. High-capacity magazines, they're hard to obtain right now. And we consider anything over 10 rounds a high-capacity magazine right now based upon the buzzwords that are going around everywhere, you know. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. The sporting rifles, can you explain to me what a sporting rifle is?
Well, a sporting rifle is anything that doesn't look like a old traditional, your grandpa's rifle. It may function the same. I'll give you an example. Remington, say Woodsman, is a semi-automatic hunting rifle. It has a magazine, and every time you pull the trigger, the gun fires. Okay. Same thing with what we call the AR-15, which is a sporting rifle. It's just Johnny, if you will, or Junior's rifle today in lieu of the rifles that his grandfather or his father used, and it works under the same principle. It's under a semi-automatic mechanics.
Okay. Thanks, Tracy. For Lena, let's talk a little bit now about the mental health concerns associated with gun control legislation. This is just the current state of the mental health field and its connection to what has been grouped now associated with gun control. If you could tell me about any patient privacy concerns that affect a clinician's ability to report a violent person who has access to a gun?
Okay, well, first of all, having access to a gun has nothing to do with our reporting. The only thing that we are allowed to report is imminent danger. And so that can mean imminent to self or someone else.
And how do you assess that? I mean, what are some of the, I guess, are there... without getting into the details of how you assess every single client, what are things that you look for?
Well, imminent really honestly relies on the self-report of the client. There are certain things we can look for as far as prodromals for a certain symptomology, whether or not the person's psychotic. But unless the person's admitting to some sort of intent, there's very little.
Of the most recent mass shootings, the shooters have been have been suffering from an alleged mental illness. Some they aren't able to prove, but some they have been able to prove. With the example of Michael Carneal in the Heath High School shooting, suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, I believe is the illness he suffers from. But mental illness is an awfully broad term whenever we talk about that. What type of mental illness could be considered potentially violent?
Well, Chad, I think that's a loaded question because we have to be careful not to classify people just based on diagnoses. Actually, only a very small proportion of people with mental illness are violent. Some of the stats are less than 4%. With schizophrenia specifically, only the paranoid type schizophrenia is most linked to any violent behavior when people have what are called command hallucinations and voices that are telling them to harm themselves or someone else. But in regard to percentages and violence to mentally ill, I think in a lot of ways it's become somewhat of a scapegoat to address this problem.
Currently, the background check model assesses whether or not a person has been involuntarily committed to a mental institution. Do you think that as far as voluntary versus involuntary committals, what do you think about requiring mental assessments for all weapons background checks?
I think when we talk about requiring, my first question would be, who would be doing those assessments? Are they going to be sitting them down with a trained mental health professional or a psychiatrist? Probably not. That would be in a really expensive way to handle that. And I also think it's negating the main issue, which I think is access to guns in general. But to say that someone who's mentally ill based on a diagnosis doesn't have access, I think is an extremely dangerous way to go.
So if you had your way, what would you propose for a potential piece of gun control legislation?
You know, I don't know. I think the hospitalization laws that are in place right now are good ones. I think someone who's involuntarily committed is very different than someone who's voluntarily committed. Someone who's involuntarily committed can be assumed to not have the judgment to get help when they need it. To be involuntarily committed, you have to have some sort of suicidal or homicidal ideation or danger to self or others. And so that assumption's there. Statistically, the link to danger or to violent behaviors is more closely linked to things like poverty and past criminal behavior. And so I think a lot of the screening tools that are there are good ones.
And Dave, you may have been connected to involuntary committals as a police officer. What is that process like? How do you come upon a situation that may require you to involuntarily or commit one to a mental health institution involuntarily?
Sure, Chad. I can talk about that. The involuntary commitment process in Commonwealth of Kentucky can take two different routes. One is either taking them on a citation, charging them under the Kentucky Revised Statute of Danger to Self or Others. And in that case, the officer would take the person into custody based on the officer's observations of what the person is doing, what they're saying, if they're presenting a danger to themselves or others. Not necessarily committing a crime, but it's obvious that this person is not able to take care of themselves. The officer can take them on a citation for evaluation. The other way that the involuntary commitment process is by a petition for involuntary hospitalization. And what that is either the officer or a concerned family member or a neighbor or anyone that has knowledge of an individual who is having some sort of break or episode fills out a petition. And that petition has to be signed by that person. Their name has to be on it. You can't submit it anonymously. And it has to be notarized. And then that is submitted to the judge to look at. And the judge then fills out what's called an examination and transport order. And once the judge has signed that examination transport order, the officer takes the person into custody. And it's not under arrest, you understand. It's not a crime. It's taking them into more or less protective custody for their own good and for the good of the people that they might harm. And then that person gets examined by a qualified mental health professional. That's the official term on the form. And in this area, it is by Four Rivers Mental Health. Somebody from that agency will examine the person, determine if in that clinician's opinion, that person is a danger to themselves, and they fill out a form which is called a certification of qualified mental health professional for a 72 hosp- 72-hour hospitalization. Once that's filled out, the paperwork goes back to the judge. The judge then signs another form, which is an order granting involuntary hospitalization. And at that point, then that person is taken for a 72-hour more extensive evaluation at one of a couple of facilities, usually Western State Hospital in Hopkinsville. And there they are taken there for 72 hours to be more thoroughly examined by the mental health professionals there.
We'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation on gun control and the proposed and current laws associated with gun control in Kentucky and the U.S. And if you have any questions, you can send us a Facebook message on our Facebook page at WKMS. You can also send us a tweet at Twitter. Just send it to at WKMS or email msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. And finally, you can give us a call. The number is 800-599-4733. We'll take your question and bring it into our panel, which includes Elena Chavis, who is a licensed clinical social worker, Dave Howe, who's the crime prevention sergeant with Murray's Police Department, and Tracy McKinney. He's a federally licensed firearms dealer, and he's also co-owner of First Choice Firearms in Murray. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's Friday, February 22nd. The Empty Bowls Project of Paducah is tomorrow from 11:30 to 2 at the Julian Carroll Convention Center. Empty Bowls raises money for the community kitchen. Choose a handcrafted bowl, then fill it with food from participating restaurants. The cost is $15. Volunteers are needed at the Murray Callaway County Warming Center, located at St. John's Episcopal Church on West Main Street. Male and female volunteers stay overnight from 10:30 p.m. to 6 a.m. To sign up, call 753-6908. The Murray State University Department of Theater presents Fat Pig tonight through Tuesday night at 7:30 in the Wilson Hall Studio Theater. Tom falls for Helen, a bright, funny, attractive young woman who happens to be plus-sized. He then must defend his new relationship to his shallow friends and come to terms with his own preconceptions of the importance of conventional good looks. Make reservations at 809-4421. See more community events at WKMS.org. Thanks for listening.
Imagine the best celebrity party ever, where Martha Stewart asks Jake Tapper about his date with Monica Lewinsky. Hey, there's Dax Shepard and Kristen Bell talking about her thing for sloths. And in the corner, Bonnie Raitt flirting with Carl Castle. I'm Peter Sagal. Put on your slinkiest outfit and join us for this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday morning at 9 and Sunday evening at 5.
We can expect mostly sunny skies today, mostly clear skies tonight. Highs will reach the upper 40s with lows in the mid to upper 20s. Sunny again tomorrow. Highs will be in the mid 40s and clear again tomorrow night with lows near 30. Support for WKMS comes from our contributing listeners and Cinema International presenting A Dangerous Method. The film draws on true life as it explores the turbulent relationships between fledgling psychiatrist Carl Jung, his mentor Sigmund Freud, and a beautiful but disturbed young woman. Free shows are tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at Murray State's Curris Center Theater.
Welcome back to a Sounds Good special on gun control. I'm Chad Lampe, and we are joined by a panel of guests, including Tracy McKinney, who is a federally licensed firearms dealer, co-owner of First Choice Firearms in Murray, Dave Howe, the crime prevention sergeant for the Murray Police Department, and Elena Chavis, who is a licensed clinical social worker and also is a faculty member at Murray State University. We were just speaking about the process of involuntary committal for someone with that could be a danger to themselves or others based on a potential mental illness. We were talking here during the break, Elena, about just the void in mental health in general in the Four Rivers region because of we have one major facility that tends to crisis care. But is it your understanding that there is a void in our services?
Well, I actually don't think it's specific to just this region, honestly. I think there's a void in mental health services in general. And I mean, earlier you mentioned the idea of some of the previous shooters of some of the big events being mentally ill, and a lot of them were frankly just untreated. For most of them, there's no proof that they were quote unquote mentally ill, other than people's stories and things like that. So, I think the void is not simply just about Murray, Kentucky, or the Four Rivers region, but the fact that mental health services need to be strengthened.
And, I mean, how would you go about that? What are some of the deterrents for people either entering the mental health field or people investing in that business?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in general, the more people you have assessing someone's well-being who's mentally ill, the better. A lot of times people who are mentally ill don't always recognize their prodromals or their symptoms leading up to some sort of break. So having people like case managers or physicians around them and assessing them pretty consistently is going to reduce that risk. And unfortunately, in this region specifically, if you want to go back to that, Four Rivers is it. I mean, that's essentially what we have in terms of case management.
And so you have there's one place dealing with any crisis management for the Four Rivers region, which is the Purchase region and part of the Pennyryle, to my understanding.
That's correct. And all those evaluations have to take place in Mayfield. So,
well, then you have to transport, right?
Yeah, we have to take them. If someone files a petition here in Murray on someone and we start this process here, we have to pick them up. And after the judge signs that examination transport order, we have to take them to Mayfield to be evaluated before we can have the next form signed by the judge and then take them to Hopkinsville to the hospital for their further evaluation.
And there are private therapists in the area for mentally ill. There's psych services on campus and different things like that. However, you have to have the resources to access those places.
Well, let's move on now to some proposed legislation. We've talked about the current state of gun control in the Commonwealth. And not long ago, in January, the White House had laid out its plan on gun control. And it's a broad, four-pronged approach, if you look at it that way, which includes closing loopholes in the background check system, banning military assault-style weapons and high-capacity magazines, making schools safer, and increasing access to mental health services. And Tracy McKinney, I want to start with you first about, in your opinion, is there a loophole in the background check system, which some people call the gun show loophole?
Well, and I understand where you're coming from, and our industry realizes that there, for lack of a better term, that there is a loophole in the gun show, but our biggest problems come from straw purchases. A straw purchase, if you will, Chad, is when, let's say that I'm legal to purchase a gun, but I have a friend that isn't. So I go into the gun store and I purchase the firearm under my name, and then I sell that gun to that individual. The National Institute of Justice, which is where I'm getting my information here from, and this is in response to President Obama's plan to curtail the guns. There was 47% of guns were obtained that way. For gun shows. In flea markets, there was only 13% firearms obtained through that way. Both of those are issues and problems for me as a retailer and for me as a citizen in the United States. The gun show, you have both licensed dealers there and then you have non-licensed people there selling guns. In my opinion and in my association's opinion, the people there that are selling guns without license are breaking the law to begin with. They consider it a hobby. I don't know how they get away with it, but they are there selling. They'll have a table sitting right next to a dealer that is licensed and complying with all the requirements. So if you go in, one goes into a gun show and he chooses to buy a firearm from someone that is not federally licensed, there's no background check, no paperwork, nothing. That gun comes in and goes out. I would like to see that go away.
What else would you like to see changed about the straw purchases? How, if you had the ability to stop it, what process would you use to try to stop it?
I don't have an answer to that one, Chad. That's something that we do need to focus on, though. I will tell you that in our store, all my employees will watch a video on straw purchases. We look for key behavior. And if we feel that it's a straw purchase that's taking place, we deny the sale. Does that happen? Yes, it's for real. That's not just something we talk about. We will turn a sale away if we feel that it's a straw purchase.
If you have any indication, because Murray is a small town, I'm not saying that all of your purchases come from Murray, but in the event that you hear of a straw purchase that happened, that somebody purchased the gun from your store, went through all the proper background checks, and then ended up selling it to someone else, ethically, do you feel it's your place to tell law enforcement? And if so, what could law enforcement do, Dave? So,
well, yeah. As far as me being ethical, that's hearsay when you get out that Johnny bought a firearm from Fred and Fred can't have one. But it's kind of loaded. I don't know how to handle that one.
Mm. One of the issues, Chad, as far as prosecuting someone who does a straw purchase is determining on the law enforcement side of the house what is a legitimate sale to a friend or sale of a firearm to someone and what is a straw purchase. As far as clearly defining that, the difference, I could or a citizen could go purchase a firearm legally, hold on to it for a year or a month or a week, and then decide they didn't like it or decide they wanted to turn it over for a profit and sell it to another person. And for an individual sale, you don't have to do a background check. That's, you know, from one person to another. So as far as determining what was actually a straw purchase, was it a prearranged agreement and they were going to hold on to it for a week? So that's the big problem that we would run into prosecuting on the law enforcement side of the house.
I would like to add, in addition, and Dave is correct, there's no background check required between individuals, but the individual under the Commonwealth law says that the individual selling that firearm can only sell that firearm to another individual that they know can possess it. So there could be, like, I believe it's a misdemeanor charge against that person. Of course, there's no resources out there other than through a federal firearms dealer in order for that to take place. You know, they'd have to go to the dealer, have a background check run, and then transfer the firearm. But currently that's not in place.
Go ahead, Elaine.
Well, I was just going to say that as they're talking, one of the things that's coming to my mind is this idea of registration of firearms, which I know is kind of a controversial issue. But would that be something that would limit some of this illegal transfer of firearms? I mean, Sandy Hook, for example, weren't his guns, you know?
Yeah, well, I understand.
How does that?
What are the aversions to registering your firearm?
That's infringement of our rights under the Second Amendment.
But you register your vehicle, right?
We register our vehicle. That's right. But where does it say in the Constitution of the United States that we have a right to drive a vehicle without being infringed upon? The Second Amendment gives us the right to own, bear arms.
But to play devil's advocate here, too, as far as the right to bear arms, there's still a ban on fully automatic weapons. Where do you draw the line? How was the original line drawn on having a Second Amendment right to own a firearm, but you can't own a fully automatic weapon? And would you agree that that ban is needed?
I do own a fully automatic weapon. I am properly licensed for that fully automatic weapon. Others do own a fully automatic weapon, and we're properly licensed. It's a stricter background check. I have to have fingerprints, photos, and I go through a six-month waiting period to obtain that firearm. And Chad, I don't have the answer to those. I'm just saying that it seems like that the government wants to take a little bit away each time. And I think that the government's in violation of taking the rights away for us to own a fully automatic without this additional licensing. There's nowhere in the Constitution and the Second Amendment that gives them that authority. And we've allowed that to happen as a country.
It does say well-regulated militia. Mm-hmm. In the Second Amendment. I mean, I know that's a vague statement, but...
I'm the militia, you're the militia, we are the militia, the people are the militia.
Dave, you look like you're ready to say something.
Well, from an enforcement background, you had mentioned the shooting in Connecticut, the Sandy Hook shooting. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that the guns that he used were his mother's guns, and presumably mm-hmm. they would have been registered to her to be at the house, even if they were registered. One of the issues with... registration, in discussing the problem we were talking about with the straw purchases and individual sales, certainly if an individual goes and makes a straw purchase and then if there was registration in place, they sold it to somebody else who did not register it, certainly that would be illegal. The question would be finding out for law enforcement, from an enforcement perspective, the issue would be finding out that person has the weapon and then enforcing the registration provisions, whatever those would be, if they did have it.
And two things there. Number one, the mother was very irresponsible for allowing her guns to be unsecure, knowing that her son had the conditions that he did. Mm-hmm. And the other is I've had firearms stolen from my home. And our local law enforcement, both the Kentucky State Police, the Callaway County Sheriff's Office, and the Murray Police Department, all did their jobs. The two guys that stole the guns from my home, one was already a convicted felon, and he was out on probation, and he was on probation for 7 years. He has been released out on the streets today and slapped on the hands for what that he's done in stealing these firearms from my home. As far as restitution, this happened in 2009. The court system is still not following up. It's our prosecutors that we need to be talking to. Make sure that our prosecutors are prosecuting these cases and tell our prosecutors to stop blaming this on our law enforcement and our judges. The kid was not prosecuted to the fullest. I think I've got a total of $70 in restitution paid back for the $1,200 worth of damages that they did. I may have gone off track there a little bit, but this is certainly relevant to what we've got.
So let me just clarify, is the fear, because I think it started off talking about registering of firearms.
Yes, ma'am.
So is the fear being wrongfully blamed for a crime someone else does with your firearm if
no,
it's
ma'am.
Registered, or what is the concern?
I mean, history proves that that the first step of taking our firearms away is registration. That's
history
proof.
So, I can't speak to whether or not it's direct proof, and I'm not the fact checker here. I wish I knew everything regarding that, but we can leave that statement as it stands. But I want to kind of move back into some of the proposals. Dave, there was a part of the president's plan is, I guess, increasing the availability of active shooter training situations. And I wonder, what type of training does the Murray Police Department already take part in for active shooter responses?
Well, as far as a little more broadly on the subject of securing the schools, but related to active shooter situations, as we talked about last month when I was on, we now have school resource officers back in the schools here in Murray. And that's not something that was a response to the Sandy Hook shooting. We were already in the process of that. And when we've had the money available to pay salaries, we've had school resource officers. And that's definitely a first step, not just because we have an armed officer in the school, but also because that officer's job is to help ensure the security of the school, make sure the doors are properly locked and closed during the day, make sure that the only people in the school are people that are allowed to be there, that anyone walking the hall who's not a staff member has their little "Hi, my name is" badge to ensure that they've checked in at the front desk. So the first sort of way to deal with an active shooter scenario is prevention and deterrence, and that's where that program is coming in. As far as the actual training, everybody at the police department is trained in the old model was called QUAD, which involved getting a group of officers together, and the first three officers to show up go in. But the newer evolution of what we're looking at now is training towards an active shooter response, which is a much more rapid response. And we have some stuff, I won't really go into the details. We're refining the active shooter response with the school system, working with their emergency plan. And I'm actually currently the one that's working on getting everything together to get that plan a little more solidified, so it's a little more ABC instead of a general response like we would have to any other incident.
How often does a particular type of training like that occur? It sounds like there's a lot of work that goes into just coordinating the plan and what you would do in different aspects. Is there a state requirement that police departments have to go through a type of training every year, every quarter?
No, there's not a state requirement, and we don't have necessarily a regular interval that we conduct that training on. A lot of that is up to our patrol supervisors, and they do regular training with their shift members. And they go according to the plans that we have. They get the men and women on their shift together, and they go through that training. And that actually, in a lot of ways, works out better than a formal requirement of each police department must have an active shooter drill every so often, because it's the shifts that work together are working together and going through it on their own, interacting with the plan that we have.
We'll come back in just a moment after another quick break. You're listening to a Gun Control Forum here on Sounds Good on WKMS. We're Murray State's NPR station. You can send us your questions through Facebook at the WKMS page. You could also send us a question through Twitter at WKMS or call 800-599-4737. And you can also email msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu.
John Webster fills his tragedy, The Duchess of Malfi, with pithy aphorisms.
With what?
Aphorisms. You know, little memorable sayings that teach valuable lessons.
Like when the Duchess says, "There's no deep valley, but near some great hill." Meaning great power often brings great misery.
Or when the evil Ferdinand admits that we often cause our own downfalls when he says, "Whether we fall by ambition, blood, or lust, like diamonds, we are cut with our own dust."
And even the murderous Bosola reminds us that justice is worth any price when he says, "Let worthy minds ne'er stagger in distrust to suffer death or shame for what is just."
Wow! With so many smart characters, I bet everybody lives happily ever after, right?
You're not familiar with the term tragedy either, are you?
Those are the funny ones, right?
From the Murray Shakespeare Festival, I'm Rusty Jones.
Jenny Todd, WKMS.
And from CTLT, I'm Lilia Murray.
For details on the Murray Shakespeare Festival, go to murraystate.edu/Shakespeare.
We can expect mostly sunny skies today, mostly clear skies tonight. Highs will be in the upper 40s with lows falling back to the mid to upper 20s. More sun tomorrow with highs in the mid 40s and clear again tomorrow night with lows near 30. Support for WKMS comes from contributing listeners and Artisan Kitchen at 1704 Broadway in Paducah. Artisan Kitchen offers a variety of sandwiches and salads for lunch, corporate box lunches for the office, and ready-to-go made-from-scratch meals for the family. There's more at 270-538-0250 or artisankitchen.net.
We're back with the Sounds Good Gun Control Forum here on WKMS. I'm Chad Lampe, and I'm with Lena Chavis, a licensed clinical social worker, also a faculty member in the social work department at Murray State. Dave Howe is the crime prevention sergeant for the Murray Police Department, and Tracy McKinney is a federally licensed firearms dealer and also co-owner of First Choice Firearms in Murray. I should mention that we did have Representative Mary Lou Marzian committed to attend the program and speak about House Bill 265 in the state legislature. She had a scheduling conflict late that prevented her from being a part of this, and since then our attempts to receive or to have one of the other seven bill sponsors join us today have been unsuccessful. So again, I wanted to mention that we've been soliciting some questions from our audience today. We've received an anonymous question, and I don't know that anyone here can speak to it authoritatively, but Elena, you might be best suited to answer this, and that is there any evidence that playing violent video games leads to gun violence?
That research is interesting. Not really, no. There's lots of things. Like, people say spanking is more likely to increase gun violence. You have to be careful to state something as causal instead of correlative. You know, kids who are more likely to play video games with violence are more likely to live in, you know, situations that
you could pull a bunch of
socioeconomic other variables and yeah, absolutely.
I have a question on that, but at the same token, if we watch a commercial during the Super Bowl, that 30-second commercial will influence whether we buy that product or not. I don't understand why that violent video game that they're playing can influence the decision whether they become violent and commit a gun crime.
Well, I would argue that children who are raised in homes where violence is discouraged, where they're educated about how to interact with other people appropriately, that they would look at something like that and use better judgment.
Well, we have a question now from a caller in Paducah, and this can go to the entire panel, and we'll try to limit your answers briefly to these. But we'll start with you, Tracy. What specific laws would you be in favor of to prevent an event like the shooting at Sandy Hook?
I think we need to look at our mental health issues. I think that we need more responsible firearm owners, such as the parent of the gentleman that massacred those children, not shoot. That's something that we go do at the range. Those are two things that I would look at to begin with. I don't think limiting the rounds of magazines is going to make a difference. If someone's going to break the law, they can go in with 10-round magazines and do just as much damage as they can with the 30-round magazines.
I mean, do you agree, and Dave, you can speak as a law enforcement officer here about that. Whenever you come upon a shooting death that was later prosecuted as a murder, in a rural area that it tends to be one person doing the shooting and one person being shot, how many bullets would you say on average are expelled for something like that?
Not very many. We have not had, and I did a little checking before coming down today. In the last 5 years in the city of Murray, we've had three murder investigations. Not all of them were actual deaths, but attempted murder investigations. We've had five in the last 5 years. Three of them were gun-related, two of them were not.
Which kind of goes along with the state statistic that I believe, is it 64% of deaths are gun-related, or not deaths, but murders are gun-related? Is that 64% are related to a handgun, not a...
In 2010, mm-hmm. It was 64%. Kentucky had 180 murders, and we're not talking about deaths, we're talking about murders here. Mm-hmm. 180 murders, 116 of them were gun-related, 76 of that 116 were handguns, 6 were rifle, and 16 were shotgun. Mm-hmm. Similar statistics in 2011, had 150 murders, 100 of those involved a firearm, about 66%, mm-hmm. So not a big change there. 77 with a handgun, 6 with a rifle, 5 with a shotgun.
And so 3 in Murray in 2000. The
last
5 years,
we've had 3 gun-related murder investigations. 2 were death, and one was an attempted homicide. And the size of the magazine that was not a factor in any of those. 2 of them involved handguns, and 1 of them involved a shotgun.
When you assess a crime scene, do you assess how many bullets had been expelled from the magazine, or can you? Because I guess you would have to assume that they began with a full magazine, right?
Well, we don't make any assumptions when we're investigating a crime scene. The only thing we can go on is the evidence that's actually there. We can only say this many shots were fired because we find this many bullets either, you know, in the surrounding area or in a victim, or because we find that number of shells on the ground. For example, and one why I actually did the helped with the crime scene investigation on one of those, I can tell you definitely that one round was fired because we found one shell ejected, the weapon jammed on the second shell, and we found one shell. So we know, you know, but we can't say how many they started with. We can only say how many were used. So
potentially, the argument would be that it doesn't matter how big the magazine is, people are going to commit the crimes. And
well, I guess it could go either way, though, if you think about it.
It could
be that if an intruder comes into your home and you have a magazine of 5 rounds, but it only takes you 1 to ward off the intruder, however it is that you do it, do you need the 30-round magazine?
What's the point?
Or do you need – or, I mean, either way, it's not necessarily whether or not you need. It's whether or not you need. But
I guess that would be one of my questions, is what is the purpose – of a magazine that holds 100 rounds? I mean, why do we need them?
It's not a matter of need. It's a matter of the Second Amendment and the Constitution gives us that right to own those things.
Well, let's go back to the question from the Paducah caller, though, because I guess I didn't get everybody the chance to answer. It just kind of popped in when you talked about magazine rounds that I wanted to touch on.
Sure.
Murders related to guns in Kentucky, because we hadn't talked about that. But Elena, if you could cite or create a specific law, what law would you be in favor of to prevent a repeat of a shooting like one that occurred at Sandy Hook?
Well, I think one thing that he actually did make a point about that was fair is that as a parent of a child that had any indication of being troubled or, you know, I mean, this is all media related. I don't know factually what was going on with him, but they've said things like he was troubled or he was withdrawn and isolated. He didn't have a lot of friends. That the parental responsibility or community responsibility of getting that person help is important. But we can't legislate that. You can't legislate whether or not parents bring their kids in for mental health assessments. So I think that's a really hard question. I would hope that there's some sort of collaboration between those gun owners, between people who are advocates for gun rights, to make sure that it's important to them that people who are violent and have issues don't have access to these guns.
We have a comment on Facebook from Jeannie Embry, and her comment is that at a very basic and fundamental level, there must be a strong full-time leadership and power to enforce gun laws within the Bureau that will regulate the gun industry and regulate funding otherwise. It won't matter what laws are in place, old or new. Do any of you identify with that statement? And if so, what do you think, Tracy?
I think that she's hit the nail on the head. I mean, we have laws on the books now that can't be policed, if you will, due to lack of funding and lack of personnel.
Dave?
I mean, of course, the Murray Police Department doesn't have an official position
exactly
on what laws could or should be enacted. But I can tell you, looking at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, they put out a position paper recently. And that was one of the points that they did have, is increased resources for enforcement of current firearms laws, and also a lot more focus on illegal firearms trafficking and more resources towards that. That was a couple of the points in the International Association of Chiefs of Police position paper.
I will say there's a lot of interesting responses to gun violence worldwide. I mean, if you look at Australia and Scotland, their extreme responses to their 96 shootings of really outlawing handguns in Australia. They've had no repeat mass shootings. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting or proposing that in the U.S. I don't see that as realistic. I mean, 89 out of every 100 people here own guns. But what is the fear, I guess, in increasing some of the laws surrounding gun ownership? Why is that something we're fearing? Because I think all of us would probably agree that the agenda is decreasing homicides and, frankly, suicides as well.
Well, answer me this question. Give me a U.S. city where that the crime rate has decreased, where we have stricter gun laws. For example, Chicago. I mean, their crime hasn't decreased; it's increased, and we have strict gun laws there.
Well, Chicago's a funny example. I'm actually from Chicago.
Well, and that's fine. I mean, okay, Detroit.
No, we can
Detroit.
Talk about Chicago.
I mean, you know, St. Louis. I mean, you know, those are places.
Well, I think there's a couple things. I mean, this is not something I can probably answer in 5 minutes. But one thing about Chicago is those gun laws, a lot of them were revoked. If you actually look at it, they were proposed, they were accepted, and then they were denied. And so a lot of the gun laws in Chicago aren't actually being implemented. The other thing in Chicago, most of those shootings are gang-related. So if you think about if you actually know anything about how the city functions and how some of that violence is happening, it's not going to matter if I'm standing on a street corner with a gun in my pocket and a drive-by happens. I'll still die. And it isn't about whether or not I have a right to own a gun to protect myself. It's about the gang violence.
Okay.
That's a socioeconomic issue and a poverty issue and a structural issue. I mean, that's such a bigger issue than gun ownership.
And I agree. And all of the laws that they're wanting to pass now are laws that's going to hurt the law-abiding citizens and not focus on the gang violence and the violence that needs to be addressed. They're attacking us, the people that are civil. Not all gun people are violent people. And the laws that they're trying to pass and put on the books today, like this House Bill 56, is going to hurt me. It's going to hurt Dave or anybody else that owns firearms that are not violent people. It's not fixing the problem. It is putting a Band-Aid out there for the politicians to say, hey, I did this, but it's not focusing on what you brought up, the violence of gangs and the things that need to be addressed.
We're running out of time here. We've just a couple of minutes left, and I want to get in our last question. And this is from a social worker from Paducah that just wondered, and I don't know that I have any statistics, and Elena, you might, but is there any indication that what role does the absence of a father play in causing any future violence? I mean, you've mentioned a lot of socioeconomic issues that may affect people that could tend to be violent, but what about the absence of a father figure?
I don't know the stats on that, to be honest, but I don't even want to guess. Yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at research and violence, yes, a stable, nonviolent home is probably the number one influencing factor in that, but do people in homes that have two parents, can they still grow up and be violent? Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really big statement to make.
Mm-hmm. But we appreciate the question.
However, there definitely are statistics around single parent homes and children being more likely to be incarcerated, but I don't know the numbers on them.
Again, we are running out of time. I want to thank our panel for being here today. We could probably go on for another half hour discussing some more details. Tracy, you asked me to ask you, what does AR stand for in AR-15? I thought assault rifle. It stands for?
For Armalite, and Armalite was the company, and Eugene Stoner was the man that developed the AR-15. And so everybody thinks that AR stands for assault rifle. It doesn't. He also developed the little AR-7, which we all know today as the survival rifle. So just a bit of trivia there.
Yeah, and again, an AR-15 would be one type of weapon that would be, would that be banned under the assault weapon
that's
style?
That's the ugly looking rifle that they're trying to, yeah, that's the assault rifle they're calling it.
Well, again, it's a widely held opinion that that the assault weapon ban would probably not pass Congress, the U.S. Congress. And again, the House Bill 256 in the State House has not received. It's in a judicial committee now, but it hasn't received a hearing to my knowledge. But again, it's definitely worth us talking about. And we appreciate your time, and we thank all of you for your questions, and specifically Tracy McKinney, thank you for being here. Dave Howe, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Elaine Chavis, thank you so much for coming
thank
up too.
You.
I thanks. Really appreciate it. The second hour of Sounds Good is coming up in just a moment. We'll hear music and music in the second hour. We've had enough conversation today this hour, and thank you very much for being here. Call now. I've just entered fundraising mode. We are this is WKMS FM 91.3 HD1 and 2 Murray, WKMD 90.9 FM HD1 and 2 Madisonville, and WKMT 89.5 FM Fulton. We are Murray State University's NPR station.